Molly.
Hey, Dave.
What's going on today on the What Difference Does It Make podcast?
I am exploding with excitement today. We have an explosive guest. Her name is Pearl Harbor of Pearl Harbor and the Explosions is going to be with us today.
However, we're talking to Pearl Harbor because of her solo record when she left the Explosions. She has an album that she is re-releasing. This was her first solo album called Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too, a re-release. And what else is on this record? It's kind of cool. This was originally released in 1980, a rockabilly classic, I believe. But there's some extra fun stuff on this record. What can we find on here?
Oh, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's got four bonus tracks, and it's going to be on Purple Grape Vinyl. And oh, on the CD, it's actually going to have six bonus tracks.
Yeah, very exciting. It was fun just to do the research. We dug up of her performances with The Clash and with Ian Dury and the Blockheads. She's been around and we had a great time talking with her. We have extra stuff too. Where can you find that on What Difference Does It Make?
We have lots of extra stuff that you can find on our YouTube channel at What Difference Does It Make Podcast and on our social media at WDDIM Podcast.
Also, you might know if you're listening to a podcast, you have the opportunity to like and subscribe and give 5 stars. Take advantage of that and do that right now on the What Difference Does It Make Podcast. We have new episodes every week. So when you subscribe, you will open up your podcast player on a Friday and be pleasantly surprised at what we have in store for you.
Delightfully surprised.
Delightfully. Yes, that's what we are. What difference does it make? It's delightfully surprising. Let's get into this magical moment. This is Pearl Harbor on the What Difference Does It Make podcast. Oh, hello.
Hi, Pearl.
Hi.
How are you doing? First of all,
I'm doing okay. It's a really rough journey, you know. Lung cancer really sucks. And I did the surgery and I did the radiation and chemo at the same time. And that made me so sick. It was horrible. So now I'm just doing chemo and that makes me sick too. But I think the worst is over, the doctor said. So I'll just have to suffer another month or two and then hopefully I'll have beat it. It's kind of scary, you know, because you have to wait to get the PET scan and then after you finished your treatments and then they'll tell you if you still have cancer or not or if it's spread. So I, you know, everything is so scary and uncertain. So I'm really worried, to be honest, but I'm just hoping for the best.
We are too. I know we expect to get concrete answers to these questions and there just isn't.
I know. And it's really frustrating because it's your life and it's scary, but I've learned to have more patience because there's nothing I can do. It doesn't do any good to get mad or to worry or do anything negative because it just doesn't help you.
Well, I appreciate the positivity that you are exhibiting, and we'll hope for the best, for the good PET scan.
Yeah, and the good thing about music is that music is one of my only saviors, you know, so when I feel really, really bad, I just put on some of my favorite records and stuff like that, and that cheers me up. So a word to anybody out there who has cancer, when you're feeling bad, just put on your favorite music, and it helps.
And what is the Pearl Harbor playlist when you're stuck in a chair for a few hours? What are you listening to?
Well, like this morning, I was in a country mood. So have you guys ever heard of Sierra Farrell?
No, please tell us.
She's a young gal. I mean, I think she's in her 30s, but to me, that's young. Anyway, she's a country singer and she writes her own music. She's a great songwriter, great singer, great performer. She looks really cool. She's really wacky. I love her. So I've been playing her, been playing my old Neil Young records because I know all the lyrics and I'm trying to build up my lungs because my doctor said that I probably won't be able to sing anymore. And I said, oh, no, that's not going to happen. So I'm trying, but to be honest, it's not working yet. But I'll continue to sing along with my records every day just to see if we can build up my lungs.
Well, your speaking voice sounds great.
Today is a good day, so I'm glad. I love dancing, so I think that I'll start playing records and dancing around, and then usually that inspires me.
yeah, it certainly does. I'm sure this country singer that you were referring to, this new girl, reminded me when you described her kind of a wacky dancing around. That could have been you back in.
Yes, yes. I mean, it sounds really weird if I say something like, I like her because she reminds me of me. But so I didn't say that, and I don't mean that, but she does remind me of me because she's a pot smoking nut. And that sort of describes me as well. Although now I have lung cancer, I can't smoke anymore. But, well, you know the story.
That's why we have edibles, right?
That's what I'm talking about. Very. But in case anybody is listening that has cancer, you don't have an appetite and you can easily become a skeleton. So those edibles have saved my butt. They give me a sense of humor about myself and about my life, and they make me hungry. They take away my nausea. They take away pain. So really, I find that the cannabis gummies are like a miracle. They're my lifesaver.
You're the sales pitch.
Yeah.
There you go. All right. Yeah. When you're done with all this, then we can create some marketing campaigns around this.
Testimonials.
Thanks, you guys.
Yeah. All right. So let's start marketing this album that you got. Okay. Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too. Was that your philosophy in life? How did you come up with that title initially?
In the 70s, I lived in San Francisco and I saw a bumper sticker that said, Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too. And I always liked that. I thought it sort of described me perfectly. And I like to have a sense of humor about everything, about the way I look, about my songwriting, about the songs. So I thought, Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too would show everybody that, you know, I was kind of making fun of myself.
And was it also because this was your first solo album? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. So is that, I mean, it kind of, this coming from, you know, when you were with the Explosions, all of a sudden you're doing your own thing. Was that kind of your mantra of like, I don't know what I'm doing, but this is the direction I want to go into. Is that kind of seems it, like it that's a theme.
Yeah, it kind of is, because unfortunately, you know, I love the Explosions, but I did not love that record and I don't love those songs. It's just not really me. But that was my first attempt at songwriting and being in my own band. I always was in other people's bands. I was in the Tudes. I was in Leela and the Snakes. So I wasn't involved in any creative process. So then when we started Pearl Harbor and the Explosions, the guys all liked sort of more jazz fusion, and I'm not into that at all. So I kept putting forward rock and roll and rockabilly and sort of old style music, and they didn't like it. So we clashed musically. So I did the best I could with them. And then as soon as I finished promoting the record by going on tour with the Talking Heads, which was really great. But then I decided to move to London and do rock and roll and rockabilly.
How did the move to London come about?
In 1977, I was rehearsing at a studio in San Francisco, and Ian Dury and the Blockheads, they were rehearsing, and it was their first trip to their one and only tour of the United States. And so Cosmo Vinyl was Ian's personal manager, and he was in the lobby of the rehearsal studio, and I walked in and he said, oh, you're the second most beautiful girl I've seen today. And I was like, oh, brother, who are you? You know, get out of here. And so then he said, how would you like to see the best rock and roll band in the world? And I said, who's that? And he said, ever heard of Ian Dury and the Blockheads? And I said, yes. I said, oh my gosh. And so I went in and I listened to them rehearse for a while, and it was fantastic, of course. And so I became friends with them, but I had heard of Ian Dury and the Blockheads because our band had supported Elvis Costello and the Attractions on his first tour, but we only played in San Francisco with Elvis. We didn't go on the tour or anything like that. But Elvis's band told me all about Stiff Records and about all the artists. And so he was saying, you know, you really got to listen to Ian Dury. So I got Ian's records. And so, yeah, so I knew all about Ian when I met Cosmo. And then Cosmo and I started dating. And so I went on the road with the Blockheads, and that was really fun in the United States. And then I went to London and I met, you know, all of the Clash people, because Cosmo also worked with them. And they all said, you ought to move to London. And I said, yeah. And so I did.
How nice to be so free.
It seems like you've always wanted to go places. I was reading about to you, where you just decided, like, how you landed in San Francisco is because you just wanted to go to San Francisco when you were a teenager. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I'd never been there. And I said to my parents, I'm moving to San Francisco. And I was a bad teenager and they were happy to get rid of me. So they said, bye, good luck. And I'd never been there. And it was everything I dreamed of. It was, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll and hippies. And that's what I was looking for in 1973 when I was 17 years old. So I landed in San Francisco and immediately started having a good time. And I saw the Tubes and I said, I want to be in that band. And the next thing I knew, they were having a talent contest and I won their talent contest by tap dancing. So yeah, I got to do all these things. Just everything worked out by a miracle. You know, meeting Cosmo was a miracle. Moving to London was a miracle. But I always follow my instincts. And if something says, you know, you should leave this or you should do that, I do what I like. I'm not married. I don't have children. So I do whatever I like.
Okay. Did you have any formal training tap dancing or was this just improv?
Well, when I first moved to San Francisco, I did go to a dance school and I learned tap, ballet, and jazz because I love to dance, but, you know, I was kind of goofy. I really did want to learn how to tap dance. So, yeah, I did know. I wasn't very good, but.
Good enough. Good enough to get the fees attention.
Yeah, no, I was wearing a skimpy boxing outfit with, you know, short shorts. And I think that probably helped.
Play to your audience. Good job.
So how was that experience with the Tubes?
Oh my gosh, it was fantastic. It was my first experience, you know, working with, you know, rock and roll people. And that was a circus, you know, backstage. It was, oh my gosh, I can't even describe it. Naked people everywhere, everybody doing drugs. I was very shy and quiet. And there was a drag queen named Doris Fish, who also was in the show. And she showed me how to do my hair and makeup. So every night while we were backstage, I had this drag queen painting my face so that I looked like fantastic, whereas I was just this plain hippie girl, you know, and then all of a sudden I looked like a movie star. So that was really fun. So I learned everything from working with the Tubes. I learned about hair, makeup, being on stage, having respect for other musicians. I learned everything from them. And also Leave on the Snakes. There was a woman in the Tubes called Jane Doornacker, and she wrote Don't Touch Me There. And she was a keyboard player, and she had an all-girl band. And so she asked me if I would be in her band too. And so I learned everything from her as well.
And then you spent the time with her, and then that's when you went on your own. Is that when the explosions happened? Exploded.
Yeah. So I was with Leela and the Snakes in the Tubes in 76 and 77. And then I think it was end of 77 or beginning of 78. I left Leela and the Snakes and took the bass player and drummer with me. And we formed Pearl Harbor and the Explosions.
You didn't have any all-female bands. Was there any support for that? Or was there any pushback? What was that like?
Well, San Francisco was so, you know, it's so open-minded, all the people there, that, you know, being in an all-girl band didn't seem weird at all. And San Franciscans, you know, San Francisco people, they were at all the shows were packed. That was in the day when you had to do four sets a night. You start at 9 in the evening and you end at 2 in the morning. So playing in small clubs, doing four sets, that was a lot of work, but we were young and we had a good time.
So what was the scene like in 1973? Was the hippie scene over? What was it like? Was it a new music scene blossoming? What was going on?
Friends of mine worked for Bill Graham. So I went to all the Bill Graham shows, you know, saw The Last Waltz. You know, I saw every great musician, Joni Mitchell back then, Jackson Browne, the band, Bob Dylan. I got to see everybody. So I was really lucky and I was very influenced sort of by everybody. And then when I got to work with the Tubes, that was 1976. So that was just before punk had started. It probably had started a bit in London, but, you know, I wasn't that familiar. The rock scene in San Francisco was fantastic, but then when the punk rock new wave thing started, that's when I really felt like I could do something because I didn't think I was that great of a singer or songwriter. So,
Let me step back really quick. Were you at the last waltz? Were you there?
Yes.
You were there. Okay.
Dave's going to obsess over this.
No. I mean, it's my Thanksgiving tradition. I've never talked to anyone who was actually at that show. Because they served you food and there was ballroom dancing. So what was that like? Please paint a picture for me just so I can kind of have something.
It was amazing. You went to the let's see, that was at Winterland, which is of course a huge venue, and so on the floor was just rows and rows and rows and rows of tables for everybody to sit and eat. So that was very strange to begin with. You know, as soon as the music started, it was one superstar after another. And, you know, once the band got on stage, then they brought on Dylan, and then Neil Young came out, and then Ben Morrison came out. I mean, I just can't even tell you what it was like, because it was probably one of the coolest things I've ever seen. I mean, touring with the Clash was probably all my favorite thing that ever happened to me. But the last waltz, oh, I wish that you had gone, because you would have loved it too. Everybody was great, and everybody had a great time. And after the food was over, you know, they took away the tables and everybody was, you know, just dancing, and everybody was drunk and smoking pot, and it was just wonderful.
It's just the music and the whole environment.
Yeah, the music, everybody. Jeez, I couldn't believe all the wonderful people that I saw. It was too much.
We are talking with Pearl Harbor, and we have arrived at the break. Let's get into it right now. We'll be back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And we're back on the What Difference Does It Make podcast with our guest, Pearl Harbor.
Wanda Jackson, you know, the queen of rockabilly. Was she just everything to you, or is that, I mean, that's
yes,
what I get.
She was.
Yeah.
Because actually when Pearl Harbor, the explosions first started, I wasn't sure exactly what kind of a singer I was, because I'd never been a lead singer. So I went to my friend John Goddard's record store in Mill Valley, which was the best record store in the whole world. It was called Village Music. I said to him, would you play me some of your favorite, you know, rock and roll girl singers? And then so I can listen to the old school stuff and see if there's anything that inspires me. And the first thing he played me was Fujiyama Mama by Wanda Jackson. And I just had a cow. I said, that's exactly what I want to sound like. And to tell you the truth, I sort of sing like her anyways. We have the same tone. I sing in the same key as her. I mean, obviously, she's a way better singer than me. But, you know, I bought that record and just played it over and over. And, of course, the guys in the explosions, they didn't like it. And they said, no way, mindless rockabilly, you know, forget it. So I just kept Wanda Jackson in my head when I moved to London. And London already had a rockabilly scene, and that was before the Stray Cats or anything. They had rockabilly clubs, and everybody dressed 50s and did all the line dancing. And you could go to record stalls at flea markets and find all kinds of obscure rockabilly records. It was a maze. I went to the right place going to London.
Okay, so you get to London. Cosmo was the, you sort of went with them. What happens when you get there? I mean, how do you start? Like, how do you launch into the scene there?
Well, the first thing he did was he introduced me to Nigel Dixon, who was the leader of a rockabilly band called Whirlwind. And he was great. And Cosmo said, why don't you two get together every night and try to write an album's worth of material? So that's what we did. So I would go to Nigel's flat every night and we'd get drunk and just have a ball working on rockabilly music. So that was the first thing that I did. And then when we thought we were ready to record, Cosmo said, right, well, I'm going to get some of the Blockheads and some of the Clash to play with you. And I was like, oh, yes, please. So, I mean, recording that album, Don't Follow Me Unless To, I just had so much fun. I can't tell you one negative thing. I mean, we did it all in 3 weeks. And most things were one take and not very many overdubs, because the Blockheads and the Clash and I all agreed that 3 minutes was as long as any song should be. Lots of doodly overdubs were no-go, and keeping everything simple and raw was the way to go. And so that's what we did, and that's what happened. So, I mean, just working with those folks, Wilco Johnson, I mean, he is the best rhythm guitar player in the whole world. He's the weirdest guy. He wore the same clothes every single day, and he was a speed freak, so he didn't eat. All he did was drink tea. He didn't drink alcohol, didn't smoke cigarettes. He's just this odd character who was the greatest musician ever. And I had two drummers, Topper from The Clash, Steve Goulding from Graham Parker's band, and they were fantastic. And of course, Paul on bass, and then various people on lead guitars and keyboards and stuff. So it just worked out great. And I was so lucky, very, very lucky to have all those people work with me. They liked me, and I didn't know why, but I think they thought I was a nutty American girl, and they had never worked with an American girl before. And I immediately music lover, and I know my music history, and I collect records, and that's what we all had in common.
So, producer Mickey Gallagher, also of the Blockheads, did he have like a vision of what this album should be like? Or was it just you brought him these songs and like, this is what I want to do. Make this good.
Do your thing.
Yeah, that's what the latter is exactly. These are the songs. If you like it, it would be great if you produce the album. And if you don't, we'll find somebody else. And he said, no, that he really, really did like it. You know, to be honest, the production of that album, it lacks a little bit because it was done so quickly. And a lot of things aren't, like the vocals could have been mixed a little bit different and so on and so on. There's a lot of people, especially Warner Brothers, threw me off the label because they hated that album. They hated the production. They hated the songs. They said, there's no hits. And what they did like was Pearl Harbor and the Explosions. So they were really mad at me when I left and moved to London. And then I hand them this wacky album and they are like, forget it.
Right. But yeah, 2 years before the Stray Cats come along, you were just ahead of your time. With this new album, was there a chance to remix it at all? This album's coming out again. So was there any changes to it?
Not really. I think they tweaked it a little bit so that it's a little bit more present. So it pops a bit more. It's not quite so flat. But no, there was no chance to completely remix it because it was on, you know, 2-inch reel-to-reel. And there's no way that I could go into a studio. I couldn't afford to go into a studio. And I do have the original tapes, but I couldn't do anything with them. It's a shame. I wanted to remix it, but I couldn't.
Did you write the liner notes for the re-release?
Yeah, there's liner notes for the re-release. And yes, I did write those. And for the original record, there are no liner notes. That's another thing that Warner Brothers were pissed about was because, you know, it was the Clash and the Blockheads, but I did not include their names on the record because I thought the British press were really, really tough and they didn't like Americans. And I was told that, you know, if you make an album and all the musicians are these famous guys, the British press will just bury you and say the only reason anybody likes this record or listens to it is because of the Clash and the Blockheads. So Cosmo suggested that I didn't credit anybody and I just handed them this blank record and it was sink or swim and it basically sank.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. Now, to be honest, I wish that I had, you know.
Sure.
But it doesn't matter. Hindsight, whatever.
Yeah. Well, let's look back at some of these songs because did you write songs? How confident of a songwriter were you at the time?
Not confident at all, but that's why Cosmo hooked me up with Nigel Dixon because he is a good songwriter. So, you know, he taught me a lot about songwriting. Ian Jury taught me a lot about songwriting. He gave me my thesaurus and a rhyming dictionary. He taught me how to use them. He taught me how to speak with the British press so that they wouldn't make fun of me. Ian taught me a lot, so I was very lucky.
And what is the secret to talking to the press, the English press?
He said, be as interesting and amusing and funny as you can. Make up stuff, lie about things. You know, he said, they'll lie about you, so you might as well lie to them. But he said, never, ever say anything negative about other bands because they'll try to get you to do that, especially other females and stuff like that. And he said, just love everybody and always be funny and try your best to be interesting and don't fall into their traps of trying to make you sound like an idiot or negative stuff.
Good advice.
I would make up stories that I knew were funny and stuff like that. And actually recording with the band was, there's so many funny stories, I didn't really have to make much up.
What was the first song you and Nigel wrote?
I know what it was. It was Do Your Homework. That's the first song that Nigel and I wrote together. And then Alone in the Dark, that's probably the second one. You're in Trouble Again, that was probably the third. Everybody's Boring But My Baby, that was probably the fourth.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about Everybody's Boring But My Baby. How'd that come about?
Well, Nigel and I both love girl groups, and I always tried to look like Bonnie Spector. I said, let's try to write a girl group song. And so Nigel knew how to play. He just played on guitar some very simple chords that sounded like 60s girl group stuff. And it just worked out really easily. It came together and I can't explain how or why. When I walk home at night, you
What about a song like Out With The Girls? What was that like?
That one was a true story. It was, I think that I had gone out and gotten drunk with my girlfriends and all this crazy stuff happened. And so the next day I just wrote down the story of what happened and brought it to Nigel. And I said, you know, make it be sort of like Hot Rod Lincoln. And perhaps it's a bit too much like Hot Rod Lincoln, but oh well.
Nothing wrong with that. That's a good, it's a good song to emulate.
Yeah, really. Thanks.
Me and the girls were fooling around. Went to a gig in Camden Town. Before we got in, we saw a big old fight. With stuff like that, I never had. One guy's head was bleeding down his feet. The other guy was flat out in the street. We just walked right past, straight into the door. I didn't offer to help. I never seen him before. Got our tickets, went straight to the bar. I started with beer, then switched to vodka. The music had started. It was really bad, but I was out with the girls, and I was really glad. Drinking.
How did you pick some of these cover songs? So like the Ian Dury song, what did Ian approach you? Or did you go like, this would be a good song for me to cover?
I asked Ian because I was familiar with all his songs. And I knew most of the, you know, how to sing most of them. Because I always sing along with all my records. And Rough Kids, I just liked that song. And I liked the lyrics. And I thought it would be an easy song to sing. And I asked Cosmo if he thought that it was a good song for me to do. And he said, absolutely. And then he said, let's ask Ian. And then Ian said, of course. And so that was that. I just love the lyrics to Rough Kids.
You're partially Filipino, is your on your...
Yeah, my mom.
Okay, is that why, were you familiar with Filipino baby?
I remember when I was in London, and like I said, I would go collecting records at the rockabilly stalls. It was either Cosmo or myself found the record that said Filipino baby, and we bought it because it was Filipino baby. So I'd never heard the song before. And then when I got it home, apparently that song has been recorded since the 20s by lots of different artists, you know, country people. And my version I got it from was Cowboy Copas. And so that was from the 50s. But the lyrics were great. And the lyrics describe my parents. You know, my dad was in the army. He wasn't a sailor, but he was in the army and he goes over there. And it's just the same as all the soldiers and sailors. You take them to a foreign land and they see all these exotic women and they fall in love. And that's, you know, some people think that that song is very racist, but it isn't to me because the singer is saying, you know, and he said, I love my dark-faced Filipino. And people would go, how can you say that? Now when I do that song live, because I still do it, I always say, and he said, I love my darling Filipino. So I changed dark-faced to darling. But dark-faced, my mother is dark-faced. She's brown. And my dad is this blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy. And he goes over there and sees, you know, falls in love with my mother and marries her and brings her back to the States. And, you know, that's what a lot of soldiers and sailors did.
Sounds like the Elvis Presley story, right? Is that what's going on?
Kind of, I guess so.
Well, yeah, because you grew up in Germany, right?
Yeah.
Because that, I believe Elvis met his.
Yeah, Elvis met Priscilla, but Priscilla wasn't German, and she's gorgeous, but she's like a beautiful, like, teenage white girl, American, so. It isn't exactly the same, but yeah, Elvis was in the army and he fell in love when he was stationed out there. Yeah.
And did you live in Germany most of your life? Throughout your teenage year?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I lived there when I was a really little kid, and then we moved back to the States when I was around 7. And then we lived in the States for 3 years and then moved back to Germany. So I spent all of my teenage years in Germany. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the United States very well. So, Germany was fine. I mostly hung out with American kids anyways, because I went to army school. You know, I dated some German guys when I was a teenager and, you know, made fun of them afterwards and stuff like that. Because, see, I can make fun of Germans because Germans were very racist towards my Filipino mother. Mm-hmm. And that was very difficult for me to watch. And so when I lived in Germany, I kind of didn't, as soon as I understood what racism was, I didn't like it. And I, you know, was very protective over my mother. It was hard, actually, seeing Germans making fun of my mother to her face and all that kind of stuff. You know, Germans were very cruel back in the 60s. And, you know, a lot of them were still had that Nazi mentality of, you know, not liking anybody that wasn't white. So they're not like that now. Germany is not like that now. But, you know, I'm sure there's still a lot of racism there. But, heck, there's a lot of racism here, too, right?
Mm. Yeah, there is.
We should ask about, so your collaboration with The Clash, just were you touring with them and performing just Fujiyama Mama, or what was your role during their tour during that time?
Well, I met Paul right before, you know, making the album Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too. And then we became good friends, because when you're recording with people, you get to know them very well because it's a very intimate situation. So after the album was finished, Paul asked me out on a date, and I was shocked because, you know, I didn't think he liked me like that. Then once we started going out, then I would go to all their shows with Paul, you know, to be with Paul. So I went on loads of tours with them so that I could be with Paul. And then a lot of times, you know, Joe would just say, you know, hey, do you want to jump on stage and do Fujiyama Mama tonight? You know, and I'd go, yeah.
And now we have not only The Clash, but Pearl Harbor.
Arigato, Fujiyama Mama.
I love seeing the footage of you and Paul playing together when you guys are playing live. It's very, it just looks sweet, you know.
Yeah.
Create a whole story. We create a whole backstory.
Yeah, we were young. I mean, when you're in your 20s, you know, everything is sweet. But I was so lucky. You know, I had so much fun with Paul and The Clash. I also, you know, was the biggest Clash fan. And I saw a million shows, and I got to stand in the sound booth and watch shows all across America, all across Europe and Asia. And I mean, who gets to do that? You know, not many people, but I did. I had so much fun.
It looks like you guys have maintained a nice relationship. You seem supportive of each other.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when we split up, it was sad because he found somebody else that he liked better. Tell you the truth, it was at Joe's funeral, which was 2002. You know, when I went to that, I took Paul aside and I said, you know, we should just bury our differences because we had so much fun together and let's just be friends. And he said, yeah. So we've been friends since then and we email each other all the time and he sends me drawings and paintings and we're very good friends. And I'm very lucky and very thankful for that as well because he's a nice guy. He's very creative. He's just a womanizer, that's all. He's this charming, handsome guy. And so, you know, everybody wanted to go with him and all those models and stuff. It's kind of hard to compete.
Well, you're the bigger person.
Thanks, Holly. Yeah.
Because you're re-releasing this album, Don't Follow
Me. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some extras on here where I guess there's Nerves and You Got Me Wrong. These are all unreleased songs?
Nerves and You Got Me All Wrong. Those were the B-sides of Fujiyama Mama and Cowboys and Indians, which were two singles that they put out, that Warner Brothers put out, but did not promote or anything. So, yeah, those were the B-sides of those singles. Nerves was the first song that I have ever wrote by myself, actually. And I wrote that in the 70s for the Explosions. And, of course, they said, heck no.
And so, yeah, you recorded it during those sessions, right? At the same time?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
But it just didn't make the cut. That was the time where you had to keep it down to like 35 minutes for an album?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I saw in an interview you had a nudie suit.
I do. I have a nudie suit. One of my brothers found it for me at a flea market and gave it to me for Christmas. And it fits perfectly. And apparently, because he got it in the Bay Area, apparently it belonged to the drummer of the Doobie Brothers. But he must have been really small. Yes, I still have it. And I have a country. Before I got sick, I had just started performing with my new country band. So I was going to be able to wear the nudie suit, but I didn't yet. But yeah.
There's a goal. Right? Where when we see you, we're going to see you in that nudie suit.
Yes, please.
So do your marketing best. What's unique about this re-release of Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too?
Well, first of all, the Warner Brothers, as I said earlier, they didn't like it and they didn't promote it. And they only printed up a few hundred copies. So hardly anybody has heard that record. And I really like the record. It's really my favorite record that I've ever made. And then, of course, the stories behind it, which I'm telling you now, are all interesting. And I do want to, you know, let everybody know that I did make this record with The Clash and the Blockheads. And I think that people will like it, especially Clash fans and Blockhead fans. But we'll see what happens. I mean, all the Clash fans and the Blockhead fans are my age. And so I hope that the young kids that are Clash fans and Blockhead fans will latch onto it and find it interesting. But we'll see. I don't know what's going to happen, you know. But I'm hoping for the best. And I'm glad that I got to put the record out there again and to let everybody know who's playing on it. And, you know, what a good rock and roll record it is, really, I guess, if I might say so myself.
Well, I know you're going to get better, and we'll see you up on stage and singing Fujiyama Mama again.
Yeah.
I look forward to that time.
I really appreciate, you know, you guys asking me, and I enjoyed speaking with you. So thank you, Dave, and thank you, Holly. And good luck with all your programs and everything.
Thank you so much for doing this, and we will keep good, healthy thoughts.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I have positive thoughts about everything, too.
Take a gummy, and we'll talk soon, okay?
Yes, I will. Now I'm going to go get my gummy.
Take care, okay?
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Another one for the archives, don't you think?
I definitely think so. What a delightful guest Pearl is.
I love talking to these people, learning their stories. Who, growing up, it wasn't necessarily something I listened to that was played on K-Rock and that I was too much aware of. But then you're like, yeah, you know what? I know The Clash. I know Ian Dury and the Blockheads. She was right in there. And so it's exciting and kind of thrilling to hear these stories from someone who was really on the inside at that time.
Yeah, and somebody who has a great story herself. I love hearing about her childhood and her wild move from Germany to San Francisco when she was 17. That was just, you know, that story. In our minds, this is what I'm doing, you know.
Okay, so let's say you're living in, you're going to school, high school, senior, 17, and you tell your dad, I want to move to England. What would he say?
He'd say, good luck with that.
Oh, really? Okay. He'd give you some money and like, okay, Holly, see you later.
Not sure he would have given me money, but he might have encouraged my wild side a little more. Possibly. That's what I want to believe.
Interesting. Well, he is a gambler, isn't he? He loves to. So it's like, you know what? Go. Enjoy. Have fun, Holly. Good to
know. He's a gambler. And remember, when he was 30, I know that was older, but he piled two young kids in the car with my mom and drove across the country to California and started a whole new life there. A little older than 17, but still adventurous.
Yes. The difference with Pearl is that she went on her own, just the knowledge of like, I think I want to go to San Francisco. And she did it and got right into the scene immediately. So I love hearing those stories.
Me too. We can live through her.
Yes. We live vicariously through Pearl Harbor. That was very cool. The album is Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too. It's on Grape Ape. What is it? Purple? What type of purple is this?
It's on purple grape vinyl.
Love it. Okay. I don't know why purple, but why not?
Actually, having spoken to her now, I think it fits her personality.
Probably. Well, great chat. We do this every week. We have great chats every week. So please subscribe, won't you?
We do it every week. And if you follow us on social media, we'll keep you apprised of everything we're doing at WDDIM Podcast and on our YouTube channel at What Difference Does It Make Podcast.
New episodes every Friday. And who knows who's coming up next week? I don't know. We're going to find out. I'm excited.
I'm excited too.
All right. So until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.